Welcome to Positioning 365 Beyond Seating, presented to you by Ultimate Medical, the makers of Easy Standard Zinc Standards and Activate Bath Safety Equipment. I'm Mary Ann Girardi, a clinical education specialist here at Ultimate Medical and a physical therapist and a RESNA certified ATP. My co-host today is a member of our clinical advisory board, Doug Levine. Doug has been a physical therapist since 1997 and has primarily focused on pediatrics. Since starting Growing Places Therapy in 2006, he and his company have served over 600 children and their families, providing pediatric physical, occupational, and speech therapies in the home, school, and daycare settings. He has provided education and trainings with Cure Duchenne in the area of Duchenne's muscular dystrophy for therapists and families here in the U.S. and internationally since 2016. Welcome, Doug.
Thanks, Marianne. Great to be here with you today.
Today, we will be talking about the process to obtain a standing device, which has many components and can be confusing at times, but there is a common path. We hope to provide our listeners with a better understanding of the process. Our guest today is Jill Strickler-Page. Jill is a physical therapist and a recently retired ATP from Massachusetts. She spent over 40 years working with individuals, their families, and their care teams through the process of obtaining complex rehab equipment. Welcome, Jill. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, nice to be here. I started my career in pediatrics as a physical therapist in 1979 in Florida. Then I went on to an acute care teaching hospital there. Moved to Boston in 1982 to a large teaching hospital where I focused on adult rehab with a specialization in spinal cord injury, both in an acute care, inpatient, and outpatient rehab setting. It was a unique environment as we were able to follow patients from their initial injury through the ICU all the way through rehab and then into outpatient. I became the supervisor of the spinal cord unit there and also ran the equipment clinic, which we covered inpatients and outpatients. The focus of the clinic was primarily wheeled mobility, but we also saw patients for ADL equipment, including standers. In 1994, I changed my focus to the supplier side. I became an ATP in 1996, and I think that was the first RESNA ATP exam that was offered. I worked for a local rehab equipment provider, Atlantic Rehab, which was bought by National Seating and Mobility in 2000. As an ATP, I worked in multiple settings, including hospitals, acute and rehab, schools, long-term care facilities, and clients' homes. I did do some pediatrics, but my focus was mostly adult rehab, working with clients primarily with spinal cord injuries, MS, ALS, TBI, et cetera, and working, obviously, with the medical team, including therapists, physicians, discharge planning, and clients and their families. Also, during my career, I did some teaching at local universities, both on spinal cord injury care and rehab and on equipment.
You've had quite the varied background.
A bit.
I think it gives you, like myself, we have the view of being the therapist, the provider, and working with the insurance companies that gives you a unique perspective on how to get equipment for anyone, adult or pediatric. And I thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
When I think about getting a standing device for someone, I think identifying the need is the first step. I think we see the need identified by both parents, caregivers, end users, and or the medical team. If we're talking about pediatrics, if a parent has identified the need and they come to you, Doug, first, what's your next steps?
Well, I think the first thing I want to do is find out if it's something that the parent initiated and not myself. I want to find out what their goals are. Why do they want the stander? What are they hoping to accomplish from the stander? And then we kind of, once it looks like it's, okay, this is a viable option, this is something that is going to benefit the child, is safe, then we'll go, the next step will be to go through the evaluation process.
So Jill, if it's an adult with an acquired injury or a congenital injury, how do you identify the need?
Well, I think it's similar in some ways. Many times the individual will request the stander themselves. And once again, I think it's important to know what their goals are and make sure they're realistic. If they came to me as a supplier, I would then refer them to a therapist or their physician to get a therapy evaluation and go through the normal process to determine if the standard is an appropriate piece of equipment. I think one of the main differences possibly between pediatrics and adults, particularly an acquired injury or disability, is that sometimes the individual may not have stood or done any weight bearing in quite some time. So we always make sure that they are cleared through a physician and having a bone density evaluation to make sure that standing would be a safe activity.
I know I've always asked for a bone mineral density for somebody who's been considering standing. Mm-hmm. But reality is there's no established minimum. Does True. That make it difficult in either peds or adults?
I think from an adult standpoint, I guess it does make it difficult, but I think we always felt that it covers us as suppliers, and I assume therapists also, if a physician gives the okay to do standing. And also it's helpful to know how much demineralization there is as to how carefully, I guess, to proceed or gradually to proceed.
Yeah, I think it's pretty similar on the pediatric side as well. We don't want to do any harm to the child, and we want to cover ourselves liability-wise as therapists as well. So we usually defer to the physician, whether it's an orthopedist or who's ever the primary doctor that's kind of driving the care for that child, making sure from their side that they feel like it's a safe thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to play devil's advocate. What if it's determined through the medical team that standing is not a good idea, but the client, end user, parent still want to pursue it? How do you deal with that?
Well, I'll speak from the pediatric side. I think that's a fairly rare occurrence. That's just been my experience. But if that does come up, I think we have to have that discussion. I mean, I don't feel comfortable pushing that forward if the medical team has said, we see this contraindication or we see this safety issue. I don't feel comfortable pushing it forward. So I think we just have to have that conversation with the parent, with the caregiver, as to the pros and cons. And if there's a safety issue, what I've found is most of the parents don't want to pursue it if it's something that would cause their child harm. I think there's a certain amount of trust that maybe if it's a family that I've worked with for a while, there's a certain amount of trust that they have in me that mm-hmm. That I want to try to do what's best for the child as well. So it's just really a team discussion.
I agree from the adult perspective too, although I guess it's a little different when you have an adult who's weighing in on this. And the other question is, will standing help with any bone density improvements? I don't know the current literature, but I know that was always a discussion with standing as one of the goals. I think sometimes too, I mean, we've had clients who've had a bone break just doing range of motion because they were so osteoporotic. So it can happen at any time. I think one of the other ways potentially is if someone could do more gradual weight bearing, such as using a tilt table, if it's a concern about bone density and going, directly to upright standing.
Both good advices, and it's rare that that occurs.
An adult can always say, I'll sign a waiver, but I think, legally that wouldn't necessarily hold up. So it's always a discussion to be had.
Yeah. And that's a good point. There are other ways around that. It doesn't have to be no standing or complete vertical standing. That has come up before, where whether the child couldn't tolerate complete vertical standing or it was contraindicated, maybe we can go back and say, okay, well, how about if we tilt them back a little bit? So we're getting some of the benefits of standing, but we're decreasing some of the risks.
Agreed.
So it's another way that we could go about it.
So we've gone through the desire. We found that for all intents and purposes, for this discussion, we'll say they are cleared medically. And Doug, you said you next go into the assessment. What does that include?
Yeah, I try to be as thorough as possible, because when it when it comes to pediatrics, I think there's certainly going to be some of the same things and a lot of overlap with the adult assessment. But there's usually more, maybe more players involved. So there might be a therapist that comes to the home. There might also be a school therapist that has seen that child for a while. There's the parent that's involved. So it's not just the end user or caregiver, but trying to involve as many of those parties as possible, I think is helpful. And then not just looking at the benefit of standing itself, but looking at the kind of more holistic viewpoint too. Do they have room in that house for a stander? Trying to let the family know, okay, you know, here's what the footprint of the stander looks like. Do you have room for that in your house? Is this something that you can do on a daily basis? What is your child's day look like? The last thing we want to do is get a big piece of equipment, train the family on it or the caregivers on it, and then it's something that they're never going to use. So I do spend some amount of time in the assessment just letting them know what it looks like. Maybe about, you know, once they get more skilled at it, how much time does it take to get them in the stander, out of the stander? How much time would be a benefit? You know, if we're going to do it for 30, 45 minutes, do they realistically have that in their day to do it? I try to talk about the benefits of standing and what that can afford them. So maybe not just weight bearing through the bones, but digestion, circulation. So really trying to educate the family or the caregivers as much as possible in terms of what all of that looks like, so we can see if we move forward. And then if we want to move forward, then of course we look at range of motion of the child. You know, is there a scoliosis? Can they safely and comfortably be placed in a stander? And then we would do all the regular assessments, you know, with that range of motion, head control, trunk control, those types of things, to see what kind of stander we want to go with and what accessories.
So how does it go for an adult?
I think similar in many ways. I think other things that are also looked at are, you know, the type of transfer, you know, what other type of mobility equipment is being used, sensation, you know, someone with a spinal cord injury that doesn't have sensation may not be able to give you feedback as far as alignment or pain, looking at tone. Also bowel and bladder function and management, since upright positioning, gravity definitely can help with that. Cognitive status, I mean, I think we're looking at most of the adult population, as we've been discussing, as being cognitively intact, but that's not always the case. So looking at the caregivers and, you know, what their goals are also. Also looking at skin integrity, I think we see that more as an issue with the adult population. So is that something that would be helped or hindered by doing standing? So I think that's just some of the other changes with the adult population or other things to consider.
So now we've done the eval. We figured out that a standing program is appropriate. We've talked to everyone involved and ensured that it has a good likelihood of being done. There's no absolutes in this world. And to get a stander through insurance, most manufacturers do not sell directly. So you have to go through a supplier. So the supplier also, if you're doing insurance, has to be a provider for that insurance.
Correct.
So as a supplier, Jill, what are your steps? So we've done the eval. The therapist, the caregiver, the family, the team, medical team is all signed that this is going to be a good idea for this child to get a stander. They contact the supplier. Now what happens?
I think the first thing is the supplier will check the individual's insurance to see if standers are even covered. There are some insurances that just don't cover them, black or white, that's it. And also if they do cover them, then what the coverage criteria is. And I think it's important to keep that information in mind throughout the rest of the process so that the coverage criteria can be addressed as the process goes on. And then I think after knowing that we're going to pursue the process is setting up a demo. So I think, you know, depending on the environment, if someone is seen at a rehab facility or an acute care hospital that has standers available, the demo can be done that way. If someone is being seen at home by a home therapist who does not have much experience in standers, then the ATP is more involved from the beginning to help set up a demo and do the fitting with the individual at home.
Doug, when you're looking to get a standard, do you have something in mind that you want a demo based on your evaluation or whatever's available?
No, I mean, I think it's the former more than anything. And being a practicing PT and not on the ATP side, I'm not always, I mean, I try to stay up on what's available and what's out there, but I do rely on the ATP, on the supplier to, I guess, whatever I have envisioned or what I'd like to accomplish with the input of the family, then I will typically turn to ATP. Like, here's what I'd like to see happen. I think we want to go with a sit to stand type thing, or we want to go with this, or it has to have, they're growing really fast, so we have to have something that really has a lot of adjustability. And then I look to the ATP to say, you know, what would be the best thing? Or can we accomplish that with this person's insurance if we're going through insurance? So it's, I have a vision of the goals or kind of what I'd like to see. And then I kind of push it over to their expertise.
You just described the co-workings of an ATP and a therapist. The therapist's goal is to identify the needs and what they want the equipment to do. And do you agree, Jill? The ATP is to take that information and find the product that meets it.
Yes, I do agree. I do agree.
Within the insurance guidelines.
Right. Which can be, depending on the different codes, without getting into it, the different codes, you know, have different ways of being funded. And so it's, you know, critical to know that and know what can be obtained through the insurance.
And I think, Marianne, I think that's a really important thing that we were talking about. You were saying the sort of the optimal role of the relationship and the roles of the ATP and of the PT. I think that's important for both sides to kind of hold up their end of the bargain. And I feel like I'm not an ATP, I'm not an expert, and I don't try to be an expert in every single piece of equipment or funding or all those things. But I try to understand a little bit, but I don't want to bring to the table nothing. I don't want to say, well, to the ATP, you know, whatever you think is best, I'll just sign off on it. I want to be able to say, you know, here's what we are looking for. So, and I think it's important for the ATP to have knowledge about different pieces of equipment that do different things as well.
It's interesting you say that, Doug, because I think particularly more with the adult population, we'll see individuals in different environments. I think, as you had mentioned before, with pediatrics, they may have a school therapist, a home therapist, an outpatient therapist, and the adults often don't have any therapist, or if they do, it may only be a home therapist who's seeing them just for this standing evaluation and doesn't have a lot of knowledge and honestly even investment in the process sometimes. So the ATP ends up taking on a bigger role, I guess. This also comes into play with delivery and follow-up when a therapist is only involved for sort of the initial evaluation and then is not in the picture anymore.
Yeah, that's a fantastic point. I mean, it's sort of a kind of a flaw in the system, right? That a lot of times the adults don't have a therapist that they're seeing on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So that does make it more difficult. You know, I try on my end because obviously pediatrics, I mean, these kids are going to grow. They're going to be adults. So to that point, I try to educate the families and also the child, if it's appropriate, to have somebody that's involved in their care. So even if I discharge somebody for PT, they've met their goals, whatever reason I've discharged them, I always let the family know, you know, it's still good to have a therapist that you maybe check in with on a regular basis. And I think that hopefully gets them used to having sort of that touchstone of the PT, or having somebody see them, even if it's on an infrequent basis, somebody that knows that person, so that when they do become adults, maybe they're less apt to be more isolated in their care and run into a situation where, you know, they're not seeing anybody.
Totally agree. I agree that I think it's best, if possible, to have some sort of periodic, you know, annually, you know, every couple of years, check-in with a therapist who's versed in their diagnosis.
So we have the clearance, we have the evaluation, and know what we need for supports and types of standards. What happens at the trial?
The therapist, you know, should be there with the patient and the ATP, possibly. The client is fit for the standard and then has a trial to determine how they'll tolerate it. And I think ideally the trial should occur over several different treatment sessions so that the therapist can determine whether the trial is successful and whether the tolerance shows some increase, whether the caregivers are capable of assisting as needed, to best determine if that's going to be the most appropriate piece of equipment and if it's going to meet the needs and goals that have been set forth.
Yeah, I think just to kind of add to that, I agree that trial is so important. And I understand that it's more, it makes the whole process a little bit more time consuming. You have to find a time for the demo. The ATP has to get a demo. We got to get everybody together, bring it in. But I think it saves a lot of time in the long run. And Jill, you've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing this for a long time. There's still plenty of times where I get it wrong, you know, and you think, well, they're going to need, this is going to be the perfect standard for them. And then you try it out and they don't like it, or they can't tolerate it, or there's a different one that works better. So on those big pieces of equipment where they maybe have to have that for 5 years or more before they can order a new one, I think that demo is just really, really important, even though it adds a little more complication to the whole process.
I totally agree. Plus, in most cases, the insurances require a trial that you can document to help make your case.
And in some states, they actually require 5 individual separate trials.
Do you mean with the same piece of equipment?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Which is why it's important, as you said earlier, Jill, that the ATP determines and finds the coverage criteria for the individual insurance.
Mm-hmm. I think also some insurances also require a certain amount of time to be tolerated standing. So if initially the client can't tolerate that amount, you may need to see them several times during the trial to build up to that tolerance.
Yeah. Unfortunately, each insurance is different, and that's where the ATP comes in, and the family and the caregiver or the individual themselves, because they can access information from the insurance company that neither the therapist nor the ATP can at times.
Mm-hmm. Anytime a family or a client have like a case manager or a contact at the insurance, it always helps facilitate the process.
True. So we've done the trial. We've established the need. We've established their ability to use the equipment. We've established exactly what the equipment needs to be as far as make, model, and accessories. Now what do you do, Doug?
Well, at that point, it's really a majority of it is turned over to the ATP. I've kind of done my part with figuring out what we're gonna get, like you said, all the accessories, all of that, and then I turn that over to the ATP, and they'll always let me know what they need from me, whether it's a letter of medical necessity justifying certain components or a certain type of standard, and so I'll provide those letters of medical necessity, and I think it's important. I mean, we've talked about something on another podcast, where it's those letters of medical necessity are so important to spend a little bit extra time in the beginning. Because if you don't justify that piece of equipment or those components from a medical standpoint. You know, these insurances want to know what's the medical necessity of this piece or that piece or the stander. So spending the extra time on the therapist side of writing that letter of medical necessity or justification, I think goes a really long way. And then at the evaluation, I'll ask the ATP, can you please give us an update and the family an update as things are moving along? So whether it's, you know, it's sitting at on the doctor's desk waiting for signature, or we're waiting to hear back from the insurance, or whatever it is, I just try to help keep that flow of communication going with all the parties and make sure that the family is informed so that they can intervene if possible. If it's sitting on the doctor's desk and the supplier has tried five times to get that back, let's get the family involved and to call the doctor and say, can you please move this along?
I totally agree. And I know most of the large suppliers have some sort of a portal through their website where clients or family members can check on the status, which just, you know, gives them more autonomy in getting the process moving along, as opposed to the ATP having to remember to contact them. So it's just an easier way to find out what's going on. A couple of comments I was going to make just about the LMN. I agree. I think a couple of things to always include also are just details on how the trial went and, you know, how the stander was tolerated. I think a couple of key phrases are that the client and caregiver are safe and independent in using the stander, and that the environment can accommodate it. And then also, most insurances are requiring a detailed, quote, prescription for the use of the stander incorporated within the LMN, like how many times a week and for what duration is the prescription given by the therapist to the client for using the stander. And then I think another key thing is that you have to rule out less costly options. So whether that be less costly standers or just other interventions to prove that the stander is the most medically necessary piece of equipment. And then any research that can support the justification is always helpful.
I've also seen recently where not only are they looking for a prescription of how often they're going to use it, how they're going to use it, frequency, duration, but also goals, both long and short-term goals of the stander and the program at home or wherever it happens to be. But
And I think that's what it helps, with a longer trial, say, you know, one of the goals is to decrease tone, you know, with prolonged standing. And if you have seen that occur during the trial, being able to document that, you know, adds extra weight to the LMN.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, I try when writing those letters on behalf of the patients, I try to write those letters as if I were the reviewer or looking at it. And so if I'm the reviewer, if I've seen that a trial has been done and I've seen that, you know, you've addressed possible less costly options, there's research that goes along with this, you know, it's really kind of an airtight case. I think I would think that, okay, this has been given some thought. This has been given some time because they've gone through all these different hoops that need to be jumped through. They're not just saying like, well, let's get this piece of equipment and see what happens. So I think that can save time as well, just thinking about all those different things that the reviewer would look at and have that included with all the paperwork that's being sent.
Absolutely. I think also it's difficult sometimes to step aside and look at it from a different perspective because you know the child so well or you know the patient so well that it's really important to be able to paint a clear picture for the reviewer who has never met this person. So sometimes, not always, but sometimes we've include, you know, videos or pictures to help support a decision if that's helpful.
Right. I agree.
So Jill, we've talked about what's the paperwork and the documentation that's sent to the insurance company. Can you give us a little more detail on what the supplier needs to send in?
Sure. In addition to the LMN from the therapist, we need to get a specific prescription from the doctor. It usually needs to include the individual's name, date of birth, the date, the diagnosis, the items that are requested, and the doctor's signature, which also needs to be dated again. Even if there's a date at the top of the prescription, usually they need to also date their signature. And then if the insurance requires, you know, anything else on that prescription, very often they also need to co-sign the LMN. The supplier also needs to get a quote from the manufacturer showing cost and retail pricing for any items requested, the base of the standard and any accessories. And then all of that information, once it's all compiled, gets sent in to the insurance company.
So we've got this huge packet that's gone in. The yep. family, the therapist, the ATP has invested a lot of time. You've identified the goals. You found a way to meet the goals. And it gets sent to the insurance company and it gets approved. Then what Yay. Happens?
That's the ideal situation. Once it gets approved, usually the client and the supplier get a copy of the approval. Sometimes the physician does. Usually the therapist does not. So we always make a point of letting the therapist know that the equipment was approved. The supplier then orders the equipment from the manufacturer. Takes several weeks. Marianne, you could probably talk more to the time frame on that now. But for the equipment to come into the supplier, it then needs to be assembled. And then delivery is set up.
So when you set up the delivery, Jill, who's mm-hmm. who's present? Who's there at the delivery?
Depends on the situation. Obviously, the individual that will be using the equipment, and I say obviously because I have had times where people have said, just drop it off at my apartment, I won't be there. And then any caregiver who may be helping the individual use the equipment. Ideally, the therapist should also be there, but that doesn't always happen depending on the situation. As I was saying, sometimes we'll see people at home and the home therapist only sees them for the initial evaluation and then is not involved with the rest of the process, which is far from ideal, but it does happen. The ATP should be there. I have found that it's very helpful when doing the initial trials for the ATP or someone to make note of some of the settings that were successful on the standing eval so that you can duplicate those when setting it up for delivery. I had a unique perspective because as a therapist, I felt comfortable setting up a stander, but my role was not as a therapist, as the ATP, and it's a fine line that we have to be careful of. For example, ATPs are not allowed to transfer a patient, so the individual needs to either be able to transfer independently into the equipment and or have a caregiver, you know, that can help with the transfer. So usually, you know, it's the client, the caregiver, the ATP, and ideally the therapist at the delivery. But Doug, that's an interesting perspective. Do you do home visits also, or if someone's getting equipment, if it's being delivered to the home, are you not able to be involved in the delivery process?
No, I mean, I do a couple of things. I see kids in the home. I'm also a school therapist. But either way, I want to make sure as much as possible that the therapist is there. So whether we're, you know, we can do it in school or whether we're doing it in home, it's so important. We want to make sure that what we evaluated was what was ordered. We want to make sure that it's not just dropped off at the home and then, okay, everything moving forward. Family signed for it moving forward. So I think I try to let the parents know, okay, even if it maybe takes a little bit more time to set up this delivery date to try to coordinate it, I would like to be there to help with the process of delivery and make sure that they fit in it okay, especially if I maybe don't have the most amount of confidence in the person that's delivering the piece of equipment.
That was said politely. I totally agree with you. And like I said, sometimes with adult population, it's just really hard. Even if they were seen in a rehab facility, you know, with very experienced therapists, those therapists can't make home visits in most cases. So, and, you know, if it was a home therapist who's not all that invested and can't come back for the delivery, you know, very often a therapist is not there. obviously many adults, you know, can advocate for themselves as far as, you know, confirming that the equipment is what was requested. But I totally agree. It's much better to have a therapist there to ensure that everything goes smoothly and to help educate the consumer.
Yeah. It's, you know, there's the ideal and then there's the reality of it. And and like you're saying, especially on the adult side, the reality is there might not be a lot of people involved. And the reality is that maybe it just gets dropped off on the front doorstep or at the door. So we just have to try to do the best that we can to integrate as much of a team approach as possible.
If you ever hear of something being dropped off at the front door by a local supplier, make sure you report that supplier. But yes, it never should just be dropped off. It should always be fit by someone who has skill in doing that. But even if it's not a therapist.
Correct. Like everything in this world, nothing is written in stone and absolutes. Mm-hmm. Life happens. So the person has their stander. They're using it. They've been instructed either by the ATP or the therapist or both on how to function with it. They notice something isn't quite right. Who do they call?
I think, once again, it depends if the therapist is still involved and seeing them where that stander is. The therapist can get involved with trying to adjust something. If something is broken or there is no therapist involved, then they should call the supplier. And the supplier should, you know, help figure out what the issue is and whether they need to get therapy involved again if something has changed. Sidetrack, but it also reminds me that because the process can take so long sometimes, that the client may have changed since the initial evaluation. So in those cases, it's helpful for the ATP to check in with the client prior to ordering the stander in case something has changed and further accessories or further evaluation is needed. Just because if it's been, you know, 6 months to a year, sometimes a lot of things can change in that time frame.
Very true. Things change. And with the delay sometimes in insurance.
Mm-hmm. It's better to find out, you know, before you get there to do the fitting that the person has changed or is in the hospital or, you know, whatever.
So what if there's a denial? The insurance company will not pay for it.
There's usually an appeal process. I mean, the issue is whether it's just a non-covered item, which you should know upfront by investigating the insurance prior to starting the whole process. But there are some insurances that it just is not a covered item, and you can still try to go through the appeals process, but it's highly unlikely that it will get approved. In that case, it's more of some sort of a private funding type of situation. As far as a denial through the insurance that, you know, you had expected to pay for it, it's usually a matter of providing further documentation or further trial, looking at what the denial reason is and trying to answer that with further documentation.
So, Doug, are you ever involved in follow-up after for an appeal, providing additional information?
Yeah, absolutely. I really try to be an advocate for my patients. And so I'm happy if it's a piece of equipment that I really feel strongly about, that I feel is really needed for this patient, then I'm willing. And I'll tell the families this, and I'll tell the supplier this. I'm willing to appeal as much as you want to. I'm willing to write whatever is needed. I try to get the family involved in this appeal process as well, because sometimes they don't want to wait. Sometimes I tell them, or the supplier will tell them, that the appeal process, like, this might, we might get this approved, but it may very well may add, you know, 2-3 months onto the process of getting this if we get it approved, or we could go with this other one that will work, but not as well, but will work. And that'll probably get approved right now. So I try to involve the family with the decision-making as well, but I'm happy to be as involved and fight for the patients as much as possible.
I think that's important to getting the patients involved, because a lot of times they just sort of expect everyone else to take care of the appeal process. And I think it's important if someone really wants a piece of equipment that they advocate for themselves.
Absolutely. And I think it carries more weight. The supplier, you know, has a vested financial interest in getting that approved, and the PT may or may not care. But if there's a parent that's going to call a case manager or call the appeals thing or show up for some sort of hearing, fair hearing or something like that, I think that carries a lot more weight. At least that's what I've seen.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So we've gone through the appeal process. The insurance is still denying it. The family consumer can buy it privately. How would that work, Jill?
Well, they can do it one of two ways. They can do it through the supplier that's been working with them, who already knows the situation and can and should still follow through with an appropriate, you know, fitting education, et cetera. They could buy it privately online, but then you don't get any of the other services associated with using a local supplier. It's usually drop shipped to the door. It may not be assembled. There's no fitting involved. There's no follow-up. There's no repair service available. If the cost difference is sufficient enough and the client is aware enough and can take care of a lot of those things themselves, then it may be an option, but it's, you know, ideally not the best.
And even if they buy it through a supplier, but they buy it privately, any repairs, modifications to that, they will have to pay privately. Is that correct?
True. You could always submit to the insurance, and if the insurance changed, it's possible the insurance might pick up on those things, but most likely it would be something that would be a private pay.
I want to thank Doug Levine and Jill Strickler-Page for joining me today in this discussion about the process for obtaining standards. We've learned that the initial step is to identify the need, then to work with the therapist and the supplier to evaluate and determine the exact specifications of the standing device. Including that is a trial where they can determine if things will work or not. Then the documentation by both the therapist and the ATP are sent to the insurance company for approval. If it's approved, the equipment is ordered, and it may take a few weeks. It could take 6 weeks for the equipment to come in and be delivered. It's delivered, it's fitted. The client will then start using it. If there's issues or they have questions, they can go to the ATP or the supplier. I really want to thank both Jill and Doug for bringing their expertise to this discussion. Does anybody have anything to add?
No, I think I'm good.
Yeah, thanks, Marianne. Thanks, Jill. This is a really good discussion. It's there are a lot of components to getting this piece of equipment, and I just think communication and having everybody on the team involved is crucial.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you both again, and thank everyone for joining us on this edition of Positioning 365 Beyond Seating. For additional information on our products, please visit our website, www.ultimatemedical.com. On our website, you will find product-specific information, stories of people who use our products, and continuing education for both end users and therapists. Thank you all again for joining us, and we'll see you next time.